Bulletproof Radio, a state of high performance.
You're listening to Bulletproof Radio with Dave Asprey. Today's cool fact of the day is pretty much confirmation that the internet changed your brain. A team of researchers from across the globe just found the internet is producing both short-term and sustained alterations in different areas of cognition, which affect your ability to pay attention, your memory process, your social interactions. In other words, you're already a cyborg. You just didn't notice it. And this is a first-of-its-kind review. It was published in World Psychiatry Journal. And we're talking Harvard University, King's College, Oxford, University of Manchester, a few other big things like that. They all collaborated to say, what is going on with our brains? And then they looked at other studies that come from the areas of psychiatry, psychology, even neuroimaging, and said high levels of internet use, including limitless streams of prompts and notifications, means your attention is constantly divided, which decreases your capacity for maintaining concentration on a single task. And that actually changes the way that you store information and even the way you value facts and knowledge and in your brain. And they're basically saying, we don't really know what this is, but we have, quote, deep concerns about the potential impacts of increasing internet use on the brain and how it's altering the structure, the functioning of your brain, as well as the social fabric. So what did you do? Stop using the internet? No. Turn off the damned alerts on your phone, even the ones that say there's a new episode of Bulletproof Radio. It doesn't matter. You should have no alerts in your life. You know how many alerts I get on my phone? I get text messages from some people come up. And that's it. I don't get emails. In fact, if your phone right now, you need to pull over if you're driving. If your phone gives you email alerts, you need to pull over and turn that off. It'll actually change your brain. It's that big of a deal. And social media, you know, who cares who is following you right now? I don't get any of that stuff. Someone hit you up on Instagram, it doesn't matter. Go to Instagram when you want to and look at them. So this is just a really big, across the globe, top university study saying, no, that stuff is messing you up. And yeah, maybe there's other things that are good that are coming from having the internet into your brain. Oh, there's this little fact that you have access to more information and knowledge than a king or a president did 50 years ago. It's insane. You can do whatever you want with that. It's awesome. You don't need to go to Harvard University to learn whatever you want to learn because it's all there for free right now. And you just have to take the time to do it. It's probably on YouTube. So anyway, the internet's kind of good for your brain. It's also bad for your brain if you let it run things. But if you use it strategically, it kind of kicks ass. At least that's what I think. I don't know how much of that was a fact versus a rant, but you guys are good with that, right?
Quick question for you. What makes you feel more invigorated, less stressed, and more in control of your body? The answer, more energy. Specifically, more quantum energy, because our bodies are quantum systems. Leela Quantum Tech has figured out a way to harness quantum energy so you can reach a state of vibrancy that you've probably never felt. Dozens of studies show that Leela Q's products neutralize the effects of harmful EMFs around us and even release positive energy that can improve your blood flow, optimize your heart rate, and other benefits. Leela Q has some heavy science backing it up. A recent study looked at people who use Leela Q for just 10 minutes. The study used a special blood illumination technique called dark field microscopy, and it showed significant protective and improvement effects on blood flow. So take a quantum leap into higher vibration at leelaq.com/Dave and claim your exclusive 10% discount.
Hey there, ice bath lovers. Do you want to take your cold exposure game up a notch with some contrast therapy? Well, you should, because cold plunges and contrast therapy can lower stress, up your immunity, and even help you sleep better. It works better than just cold therapy alone. Well, now you can do that with the new Michael Phelps Chili Goat Cold Tubs by Master Spas. Whether you want to relax in a hot soak or get energized with a cold plunge, the Michael Phelps Chili Goat Cold Tub has you covered. You can easily hop out of the hot water, get in the cold water, and go back and forth. When you do that, you get better results in less time, and that's what biohacking is all about. Go to chiligoattubs.com, use promo code DAVE500, and you can save $500 on any Chili Goat cold tub. I have one in my backyard. That's chiligoattubs.com, promo code DAVE500.
Today's guest is David Meltzer, who is a fascinating and interesting author. We're talking about a guy who was CEO of Samsung's first smartphone division, a guy who's had a profoundly strong career in business and has written books on actually how to be happy and books on how people succeed at different levels and what the definition of success is. And he just came out with a new book that I thought was really worth talking about today. And the book is called Game Time Decision Making: High Scoring Business Strategies from the Biggest Names in Sports. Now, I'm gonna confess something to you before I even really fully introduce David. I really don't care that much about sports. I mean, I have some good friends in sports. You know, Nick Foles has been on the show, and you know, the Bryan brothers and these amazing human beings. I mostly didn't know who they were because I like to play sports. But in terms of watching them, I actually read PubMed and things like that when I have spare time or I play with my kids. So I'm pretty damn good at ping pong. And I might watch that on TV, but I don't have time to be a fan, right? So I heard about this book. I'm like, I don't really want to interview Dave because he's going to want to talk about all these sports people. And I don't know who half of them are, even though I think it's awesome what they're doing. I just don't know who they are. But when I looked at what he's achieved in his life, Dave has done some amazing stuff. And what this book is really about is what's going on in your mind, not just on the field, but everywhere. And when people at the top of their game, you know, I did write the book called Game Changers. When you're doing things on the field, it really matters. So I think you're going to get a lot out of this interview because, it's very rare to find a very senior executive who's also paying attention and working in the sports and entertainment agency world, going from tech to sports and just saying, what do people who kick the most ass actually do? So, Dave, welcome to the show.
Thanks, Dave. I'm really excited to be here. And yeah, it's interesting because I'm not actually even a sports fan anymore myself. I just am in the business of sports. So I think that's a big change. I've always looked at sports and I was successful in this business because I didn't have the emotional big-eyed response. What I learned to do was monetize those people that actually have an irrationality. I used to call it the irrationality of middle-aged men, and I wanted to monetize that irrationality. But I view sports because of the mass appeal in order to teach people the lessons I believe that we're here to learn to expand and accelerate what we want out of our existence.
Now, you've had a strange path to get here because, I mean, you not only had all these career successes, you sort of went bankrupt.
Yeah, sort of. Yeah, I did go bankrupt.
You
yeah,
actually did.
Yeah.
And that was your first book. It's like, hey, here's how I had to come back, not just from having money, but from having money and a spiritual practice to make me successful. That's kind of cool how you you worked with Lee Steinberg. And, you know, we're talking Jerry Maguire level stuff. What I want to know is in 2014, you wrote your book about this. Okay, I hit rock bottom financially and I came back and you're a happier guy. And, you know, we've had time to chat. You actually are a happy guy, which is cool. It's always nice to see people are authentic. Why the shift to looking at what a professional athlete does? Because some of those guys seem pretty miserable. Some of the ones I've met have been profoundly awesome human beings. But you see this stuff on, you know, National Enquirer or ESPN. I think there's a difference between those two. And it seems like there's a lot of problems across all the sports in this. So why is this a population of people that we should pay attention to about happiness?
You know, because I think the successful athletes have a spirit of excellence that exists in a conscious level, even a subconscious level, meaning that I believe great athletes, successful athletes, professional athletes think, say, and do things consistently and persistently, and they create a belief or the neural pathways, as you know, Dave, in your mind, that really create discipline and habits. Where I found it interesting is that the reason I went bankrupt is also the reason that these highly functioning, successful athletes go bankrupt. 75% of the athletes that we represented 2.5 years out of playing were bankrupt, even though they had every opportunity, every chance in access to financial literacy.
Seriously, 75%? That sucks.
Yeah. And so I started really exploring the unconscious competency. Like, why is it that people have a thermostat that if we grow up with nothing, that we have to actually look at our personality traits, characteristics, obsessions, and addictions that create an energy, this genetic layer that, you know, some people think is four generations. I personally believe it's from billions of lifetimes that I carry this energy inside of me, this unconscious
billions of,
competency.
Of lifetimes of your own lifetimes? So you're like super
my soul. Yeah. Like a super, right. I'm a Judah Buddha. Yeah. Jewish culture, Buddhist blood.
I've actually never heard that. That's funny.
But I literally was looking at why do we set these thermostats? And I was able to recover because I looked at a quantum shift in my life. I was so addicted to money and the power of money. I believe money bought happiness, and everything that I did in life indicated that money bought happiness. I was a millionaire 9 months out of law school, bought my mom a house and a car, which was the only reason I wanted to be rich. And I was really, really happy. But eventually, there was only so many things I could buy. And what I learned was the power of shopping. And not just on a pragmatic level of, you know, going from a green card to a platinum card to a black card where I could go on Amazon and there's different powers of shopping. I learned that if I shop for the right things, that it would make me happy. And that a lot of athletes and celebrities, they shop for the wrong things and they end up miserable on drugs and even suicidal. But even and since people look up to these people, so we have to now create some sort of learning curve that just because you're great on the field doesn't mean you're great at all things off the field.
So what are the brands I shouldn't shop for?
Well, for me, it was the Ferraris and the Porsches and the and they're my lessons, right? I believe we're here to learn lessons, and the lessons keep on coming until we learn them. Manifesting itself in pain is a good indicator whether we've learned those lessons or not. I believe truly, though, that faith is like a green card, a platinum card, and a black card. And faith to me was that aggregate of thinking, saying, doing, believing, and the genetic side of my personality traits, characteristics, obsessions, and addictions that created a frequency that no matter what I did, really attracted with action, right? Attracted, if I got out of my own way, cleared the interference, what I wanted. I think it's so funny that so many times in our lives, you know, we can plant a seed for tomatoes. We're not surprised when tomatoes come, but I see so many people planting seeds for what they don't want. And they're super surprised when bankruptcy comes. I had planted seeds my entire life for bankruptcy, even though my actions and everything resulted in over $100 million, right? I didn't lose like a penny. I mean, it was a lot of money that I lost.
Okay. How do you actually lose $100 million?
Good. And it's in the book. So people ask, so number one, go ahead and surround yourself with the wrong people and the wrong ideas. That'll be a catalytic event to lose everything. But when you make bad assumptions, and here's the assumption I made, I didn't need any help. I was Midas. I was millionaire 9 months out of law school, multimillionaire by the time I was 30. I never, literally, every job I took, everything I did was a financial success. When I owned a golf course, a ski mountain, 33 properties, a ton of stock, I got into a lawsuit, and my ego, my need to be right, my need to be offended, my all these different needs of my ego, I went through all my liquidity trying to prove I was right in a huge lawsuit, knowing without a doubt in my mind that I could borrow against $40, $50 million of equity that I had with my private bank. Meanwhile, when I needed cash, I went to my bank, I made that bad assumption, and I said, hey, can I get $5 million? They said, no. I almost fell over. I said, excuse me, I have equity. Give me a line. No, the bank's not doing well, and we're not borrowing on non-stated income on straight equity on properties. We're going to have to go through and do due diligence and take all this time. Well, meanwhile, I'm start looking there. They needed to take more time. I went to go look for more money. Pretty soon, nobody was giving money. I missed one payment. And then the whole thing started, you miss one payment, you're not able to borrow any money. I can't sell stuff fast enough. And that's a lot of bills coming through. It's its own economy when you have that much in property. And it was a mess. And I literally, it just started to fall. I know, though, that it was the greatest lesson that I ever learned. And it took me nine years to process the lesson energetically, because I used to tell people, and I didn't mean it, this is a really good thing. I'll be fine. Trying to convince myself. But it took a good 9 years before truly internally, I know that that lesson was so valuable. And, I'll never be broke again, because I understand and don't carry that energy. I am worthy of everything I have, and I can manifest anything I want.
Do you ever want to, punch one of the attorneys who files baseless lawsuits for no reason other than just harassment?
Yeah, I think it's funny that you said that. No, you know what's so funny is that I think, you know, it's one of the passions. If I wanted to change our structure, I think our legal system is completely upside down. I would love to be able to hold plaintiffs responsible for the accusations that they make, meaning they're financially liable, that you just can't bring up. And even worse than the lawsuits is making claims on the internet that go along with a claim. Right. Because we immediately believe I could sue you today, Dave, for something completely ridiculous, post it up with my millions of followers, and it would affect your life. And then you would have no recourse against me because I could just have a tiny thing that was true. For example, you and I were in a hotel room and did my podcast. I could make up some story. And just the fact that you were in my hotel room at the podcast is enough evidence to go ahead and file the lawsuit. And in the end, it would cost us both money, but you probably would have to settle with me because it would be cheaper than the $500,000 to have, you know, all that news out there in a lawsuit. And that's our system, and it's unfair. And by the way, Dave, nothing happened in the hotel room. I'm going on record. I can never sue you. You were an amazing person. Just legally, everyone know that. There's no lawsuit coming. You were an amazing person. Yes, everybody, there's seven people in the room, tons of witnesses. He was a genius.
No, it's funny. I don't go in hotel room meetings with people. I always have the door, like the lock on the door thing opened, you know, so that the door doesn't close, because I've never actually not done that, because it just removes any possibilities, right?
Right.
Plus, having a stable marriage is usually helpful.
I agree.
Apart from that, I just know that when people go through bankruptcy, you end up seeing just like a swarm of attorneys and fees and all that sort of stuff.
Mine was worse. I had a malpractice suit that I won. My lawyer committed malpractice, and it was really ugly. And, you know, won it. They settled in 2 seconds, and everything just went into the bankruptcy, and I had a fresh tabula rasa, a new start to my life.
So let's talk about forgiveness. I mean, this is something I spent a lot of my time on. 40 years of Zen is very focused on that. You said it took you 9 years to go through and process all this stuff. Did you have a specific switch or trigger, or maybe it's forgiveness, maybe it's something else, that let you turn off all that? I mean, a lot of crap comes out in your mind when you're going through, like, you know, you have this one picture of the future, and all of a sudden, I know, because I lost $6 million I made when I was 26, and it messed with my head. It was really traumatic. So what did you do?
I first had to forgive myself, right? I started realizing that I truly had to forgive myself for all the mistakes that I had made. I wanted to turn every mistake into a miracle. I wanted to prove to people that setbacks are setups for something better. I had all these things in my mind. Now, the interesting thing was, there was one person, a neighbor, who I had bought a condo conversion from, who I blamed, right? That's the person that I was in a lawsuit with and, you know, made up all these lies about me. Like, it was horrible. Well, when I say it took 9 years, it was because I verbally could forgive him. You know, I was out there saying, you know what, I know, I forgive him. And then I'd go home and dream about pulling out his fingernails and putting Tabasco on it. You know, like I literally had very issues. So the technique that I used, and it literally went on for 9 years, and I've used this to shift my true energy, because I know mentally I can let things go. You know, I can think, say, and do the right things. But if I can't shift my true energy, then I'm going to have hateful feelings, and it's going to attract hateful and attacking thoughts. So what I do, and this is very woo-woo, I don't know if it's Zen enough for you, but I closed my eyes and I looked at the guy that I hated, and I started thinking about all the good things about him. I thought he was a really good dad. You know, he was a community guy. Like, he had a lot of good qualities, and I find the light in him with my eyes closed. And every night I used to cover him as I was hating him, and I'd find the light, I'd cover him, and then I'd picture the true loves of my life, my family, and I'd combine the light of the two, and then I'd take the light and hold it over me in my mind's eye until I physically felt a shift of energy. And slowly but surely, just like working out, Dave, it actually shifted my energy and dissipated the actual feeling. Not what I thought, said, and do, or even believed. There was actually a feeling of tenseness, of anxiety, of hatred, of attack every time I thought of the guy. And it finally dissipated to the point where I went up to him at tailgate one time, and I walked up to him and thanked him, right? I thanked him at a pure energy, and he was freaked out because obviously he hadn't processed his feelings for me.
You thought you were gonna punch him?
He sure did. He flinched, and I just grabbed his hand with both of mine, and I just said, I just need to thank you because you helped me learn the greatest lesson of my life that has truly shifted my perspective, and I wanted to thank you so much. And I walked away. And it wasn't I was just thinking, saying, and doing, believing it. I actually felt grateful. And that's what I try to do with things so I don't manifest or attract what I don't want.
Now, in your book, you talk about how there's a conscious mind, which is, you just talked about thinking, and that's what you think, say, and do. The subconscious mind, which is the things you believe, but then you talk about this unconscious competency. Where does this feeling thing that you're talking about, like, and I do viscerally know what you're talking about, but in your teaching, in your new book about offensive and defensive mindset, I don't see feeling in there. I see consciousness and unconsciousness, but unconsciousness is different than feeling, or is it not?
So feelings are emotions, and emotion mm-hmm. is energy in motion. The energy that we emit, I believe, comes from our personality traits, characteristics, obsessions, addictions, our DNA. The feelings actually come from an energy that is emitted through that continuum or aggregate. I call it faith, of the aggregate of conscious, subconscious, and unconscious being. All of those together create an emotion. And if we can shift our emotions, which is the highest vibration, you know, literally of my belief, a frequency that then can either, one, the higher frequency you have, the more aware you can be of that which vibrates lower than it, or more importantly, even at its similar vibration, faith-wise, we can put faith in something and get what we want. And it's a three-step process for me. In the conscious level, it's the law of Goya, like our friend John Assaroff talks about, you know, get off your ass. And I think there's three things we do to get off our ass. One, work hard. Two, work smart. Three, work long. And working long is interesting because most people don't work long. They have a very short-term perspective. You were talking earlier about the internet and how it affects our brain. I work in a time zone of infinity. So I work really long in my perspective. I focus on the acceleration and growth, not on the outcome. Right. And so I can achieve things through that long thinking. So that's the law of Goya. Law of attraction we talked about, which is a frequency that attracts what it was. The key to this emotional side is what I call the law of surrender. Everyone has interference. It has a corrosion. I believe we're like lamps. We're always plugged into the power, the source of all this extraordinary power. In fact, we have enough power in our pinky to light up your house for a year. And we don't use it, but we're plugged in. So what my goal of the law of surrender is to know two mindsets. The first is I only have one action that I can take in a day. The minute I wake up, I have one action. Everything after that is a reaction. So my mindset shifted to my first action is going to be to find peace or to clear the connection or interference from the most powerful source of energy, inspiration. And then two, everything that occurs that throws me off of that, these ego-based emotions, ego consciousness that causes interference, instead of trying to react to that, my reaction is going to go back to the source, go back to center, go back to peace, which I know is very Zen. And then I'll be in a better place to be productive and accessible to all.
If you were to talk to your 25-year-old self, how the heck would you have known where to go to find peace in the first place? You say, I'm going to go back to peace. But most people, honestly, I didn't understand that place at all until much later in life, until I started doing a bunch of heavy-duty neurofeedback and ayahuasca and stuff like that.
Right on.
So what's the path to peace for people who maybe haven't got there yet?
So I created a four-step pragmatic approach that actually is a transcoding of what you and I have learned over, you know, decades. And so what I do is try to make things simple. So I talk about four values. I talk about, hey, just try and be grateful, right? Change your perspective with gratitude and literally talk about the simplest form. You want to change your life. If I'm talking to my 25-year-old self, say thank you before you go to bed and say thank you when you wake up. Try to convince yourself that you get to do everything. You don't have to do anything, you know, really learn to love what you're doing. Be grateful. Two, forgiveness, right? Hey, forgive yourself. Don't worry about the other person. Just forgive yourself. Three, and most importantly at 25, is accountability, right? I would teach my 25-year-old self, hey, it's not below the line blame, shame, and justification. You don't have to do that. Ask yourself two questions. What did I do to cause this in my life? And what am I supposed to learn from it? And then finally, try to teach them about inspiration, to live first, to connect to that which inspires you, then inspire others, right? Don't search for it. Try to learn where that is. Then below that, I would teach my 25-year-old self to ask for help. That's the biggest lesson yeah. that I needed, was radical humility. Hey, there's a bunch of old dudes like Dave and I that are so flattered and so willing to take our time. Dave would even wake up early to help somebody, but literally wake up early, whatever it is, I ask for help. And here's how I'd phrase it. Do you know anybody that could help me? Mr. Asprey, do you know anyone that could help me? Mr. Meltzer, do you know anyone that could help me? I need this. Three, after you learn to ask, understand time by just being a student of your calendar. Study your calendar. Look at time. Look at sleep. Study sleep. It's 8 hours a day. It's probably the most time, the activity that we get paid for or don't get paid for. There's no work, but the most amount of time we spend in our lives consistently is sleep, but nobody studies it. It has the most impact on the continuum of the conscious, subconscious, and unconscious mind, but nobody gets sleep trainers. Nobody studies it. I do. I would drop every mentor I have. Last person I would drop would be my sleep mentor, because it's a third of my life and I want to be good at it.
You know, I had that one wrong for a long time. Like, sleep's a necessary evil. And certainly I started Bulletproof when I was sleeping only about 4 hours a night for actually quite a while. It turns out you can do that. And as long as you're pretty good during your 4 hours of sleep, it's possible. But I get my 6.5 hours the way the studies actually show. Every day I have my Aura ring on, and now for 12 years, I've had a piece of tech monitoring my sleep quality. So I have 12 years of sleep data, and I've gotten to be a badass at sleep, to the point that I get the REM and deep sleep that the average 20-year-old gets in 8 hours. I get in 6.5 hours, and I'm in my mid-40s, and it's supposed to go the other way.
And I'm with you. I'm 51.
I even write about my new book, so I'm with you.
I'm 51 and I do this.
Now, how do you monitor your sleep? How do you know you're good at sleep? Do you have a headband or something?
Yeah, I have a sleep monitor as well. I actually go in and do a sleep study every 2 years just to make sure sleep apnea. So they have a San Diego sleep clinic. My sleep coach is Dr. Mita. And so because I have two schedules, my daily routine that's unaffected, a normal routine, and then an adaptable routine. So if I go to Hong Kong, I call my sleep coach and we discuss what time I'm flying, if it's necessary to get the bed in the plane, or what position I should be in, when I should open up the,
that's awesome.
Open up the shades or not, what to eat, what time to eat on the plane, how I'm going to do these things so that I can keep improving my sleep, not depreciate my sleep. What usually happens to people as they get older and older.
That is beautiful. I love it. I didn't think we were going to go there in this interview. I'm sending you, by the way, some TrueDark glasses. I don't get jet lag anymore because of those. That's a big deal.
Awesome. Thank you.
See if your sleep coach agrees with them and likes them. All right. You talked about something else in your process of how you were able to let go of, you know, all the anger that comes along with something like bankruptcy. And you talked about first gratitude, saying, I'm going to find something I can be grateful for about this person who, frankly, sounds like it was kind of an asshole. Right. So, but first you found some little thing. So yeah, he's a good parent. He's, you know, completely baseless lawsuit and, you know, a bad human being, but a good parent. So like, okay, a little spark of goodness, right? And you use gratitude as the gateway to actually do what I would call forgiveness. And that's the process, by the way, that I use at 40 years of Zen. So like it's a process I'm really familiar with. What's standing out to me though is, I mean, you've been a big time CEO and all that stuff. That is not a common spiritual teaching. You don't see it anywhere. So where did you learn that you had to be grateful first in order to get to whatever that glowy state is that let you, you know, overlay good energy on top of this bad thing until it was gone? Like, where did you find that?
It was born in me. I was born a grateful person, but also socialized by my mom and my grandparents that were consistent. My mom made us pray every night because we had so little. You can imagine 5 boys, 1 girl in a 2-bedroom apartment in Akron, Ohio. Most people would not have the perspective that there was more than enough in my life. I actually thought when I was 5 years old and my father left that there was more than enough. And it was because my mom had this gratitude practice that she would make us, if we didn't come down to breakfast grateful, she'd send us back up to our room and restart, right?
Wow. Yeah.
So there's no negative.
Okay.
It was, so this was practice. And then I lost that. And my wife saved my life because she literally, before 2 years before I lost everything, noticed that I was living my life the wrong way and told me, who I've adored her since the fourth grade. I asked her to go study at sixth grade camp. I pursued her through high school. Wow. She hated me. High school, college, law school. And finally, I bump into her in Mexico. And for some reason, there was finally a connection and forgiveness by her for the egg I threw at her when I was 12. And we, but this woman who I would die for, and I is the best choice or decision I've ever made, told me that she was not going to be with me, that either I start practicing and take stock in who I was and what I wanted to become, or I better start practicing being lonely. And I had three beautiful daughters at the time as well. And now I have a son too, but I'm like you, I have a great relationship, and I was, you know, cold turkey, shock therapy, put back into gratitude. And that's where I built this outline that wrote my first book. I wanted to figure out, how is it I became a millionaire 9 months out of law school? How was it I was came from nothing? All I had was law loans when I graduated. I had no great skills. How was it different for me? And I put an outline together of how to take the what, the possibility, because I always knew what I wanted or thought I did, and how I became inspired, the why, and then how I actually manifested or created the perspective of the reality that I was going to get it, how I put clothes on my idea and allowed it to come to fruition. And it came from, you know, books like Think and Grow Rich, very pragmatic. I started studying The Course in Miracles. I had run into, you know, coincidence started happening. I was consulting for a guy in The Secret, Lee Brower, who introduced me to all the TLC people, and all these things are happening for 2 years. The funniest thing is, when I lost everything, I was already CEO of Lee Steinberg. I was making good money. I was a very spiritual person. I was prepared to handle what was happening. And I was really glad it didn't happen 2 years earlier, because I don't know if I would have recovered. But it was almost as if I was prepared when it happened by all these things. And I met this woman that taught me to meditate. And that was a really big part of my life. I do Theta meditation and quantum healing. And by accident, I sat next to this crazy doc. She's a medical doctor who looked at me and said, "You're so full of light, but you're blocking it." And that's how my meditation experience started, because she started explaining to me like what she meant. And I thought she was crazy.
Earlier, you called yourself a Judah Buddha. So, all right, I'm going to go back a little bit. You ascribe a lot of this gratitude stuff to your mom. Okay, where did she get it?
Her parents, my grandfather, her father, I called him he was my papa. I called him the poptimist. He you know, I always said I was the toptimist. Above a toptimist would be a poptimist. He was someone that you literally, he could find light and anything. And he was just so positive. And I know that was handed down to her. Some of these practices were handed down to her. He played piano for Benny Goodman. He dropped out of dental school and was a world famous big band pianist. His job was to make people happy by entertaining him. He literally looked at everything with a glass half full all the time. And the only thing he did, which was interesting, is he never let any of his children play an instrument, because he truly was so driven by education. And the one disappointment in his life, the only thing I ever heard him say that was negative, was, "I wish I would have finished dental school. I left dental school to join the big band and I never finished." And he drove his kids, you know, he believed the fetus wasn't fully developed till after graduate school. And his kid, and my mom, I always tell people my favorite story about my mom, because my siblings are hyper successful, Harvard, Penn, Columbia. I never knew how intelligent I was, because I got a B in high school and wanted to play football in college. So I didn't go to an Ivy League school like my siblings, but we're talking perfect scores on the SAT, summa cum laude from the best schools. And literally people say, "How did your mom do it as a single mom?" I said, very simple. She's a black belt in the martial arts. She's actually a third degree black belt in the martial art of Jewish guilt. And so between waking us up at 5 and guilting us almost to death, we were hyper successful children.
So I was kind of going there, right? So that is a stereotype, but you know, that that is a, in fact, most of my Jewish friends will talk about that one way or another, right? So most of the time, though, if you grow up with guilt and shame, you've got to do 20 years of therapy, and it doesn't necessarily lead to high performance. Or if it does, it's high performance and great unhappiness, right? So yeah. Was shame and guilt a part of your unhappiness in the first part of this?
It was more shame based, meaning I wasn't worthy of everything I had and felt very, very guilty. Guilt is an ego-based consciousness. Mm-hmm. Most people don't know it attracts shortages, voids, and obstacles in our lives. I literally remember saying to myself, you know, I was so guilty to have the money. Of course, I was going to buy my mom a house and a car first. I felt guilty paying off my law loans before I paid for my brother's college. Right? This is the stuff that went through my mind. I was not worthy of anything I received. And I would constantly, and when the only time I was unhappy, literally in my whole existence there, was when I caught my mom crying because we couldn't afford something, which created great guilt for me. Right? She was working two jobs. And even worse than working two jobs, she'd come home from a second grade teacher. She'd pack our dinners in a paper bag. She'd fill up turnstiles at the 7-Eleven and the convenience stores. The older siblings would teach the younger siblings. And I would tell my siblings, and sometimes even my mom, my dad was a shit, right? Back then you didn't pay child support. He had a wife that was closer to my age than his. He Wow. didn't pay attention to us. And I would sit there at 5 years old and tell my mom that my dad was my hero. And why couldn't you look more like dad? And meanwhile, my mom was doing all those things. That created a lot of guilt. When I made my first $10 million in 1 year, my mom made $17,000. I felt so not worthy. I remember feeling so guilty. Like, how could it be that I'm getting all this stuff and my mom works so hard for $17,000 a year and she was crying because we couldn't fix the car, right? And I buy cars like they're gifts. You know what I mean? Like I had to work through all of that. And, you know, I think the lesson of losing everything so I could readjust and find my center. You know, I wish I had your program available to me, because I will tell everybody here, you know, you're so generous to our charity, the Unstoppable Foundation, which I'm the chairman of. And, you know, one of my biggest ego boosts is people will donate money for me to executive coach them. And Jack Canfield and I, as much as people donate for that, three times as much money is given to be in your program. And people were like, can I buy one? I think it was a ridiculous amount of money and four people did it. And that's how powerful what you teach is. And I think I lived what you taught. And I think if I went to your program, it would just reinforce a lot of things that I did somehow through life practice.
You figured out a lot of stuff that most people don't, which is one of the reasons I wanted to have you on. And at the Unstoppable Foundation, I think that donation of 40 years of Zen classes, if I'm recalling right, it built four schools for girls in different villages in Africa, which is...
Yes, and I've got to see those, and it'll impact thousands of, millions of people. Oh, yeah,
I haven't twice. Been. So, I'm not sure that I have a trip to Africa on my schedule for the year, but I want pictures.
Come with me.
It was cool. I wasn't planning to do that either, but it's
awesome.
It's intriguing though that somehow you figured this out, but most people don't, and it is very easy to be crushed by a defeat. A bankruptcy like the one you went through, especially when you're flying really high. The higher you fly, the harder you fall, sort of thing. But you did something, and when I'm digging around, okay, so you had a gratitude practice from your mom. You also had some shame and some guilt, and you didn't have one guru who suddenly did this. You collected from the people you met, right? And eventually, if you're in TLC, you're running a big nonprofit. I didn't even mention in your intro. And you're doing a lot of stuff, and I find that arc to be more interesting than someone who just went up to the top and stayed up at the top. And maybe there's more to learn from that for people listening. And you've said some other things, and some of these are almost a little bit cliche, and certainly it's in my Game Changers book as well. But you say you are who you hang with, but the way you put it is, show me your friends and I'll show you your future. So here's the problem though. How the hell do you know if you're hanging with the right people? I'm putting on my 20-year-old, 25, 30-year-old hat. I hang out with the people who are my roommates, people who are in my classes, people who I work with. How do you go about when you're just getting going? What's your advice? Maybe it's from athletes in your new book.
Great. That's a really great thing, because I think there's two things we can do when you're young and we're forced to be around our roommates in our dorm room. We're forced to sit next to somebody in class. We're forced to be on the basketball team with somebody. You know, these are forced relationships. So the first side of it is those people that we don't get to choose to be around. A lot of times we call them family and friends. But all we need to do is two things. Our job to be around them is not to put faith in what they want for us. I think that's the mistake we make when we're young, is we put faith in what other people want for us because we're afraid of what we want. And so when we manifest what other people want for us, we actually resent them. And so it damages the relationship. So where do we go with other people that we have to be around? We go to understanding and we pray for their happiness. So whatever opinions they have, my goal is to learn lessons from them and understand them, obviously not let them affect me. I let their opinions go right through my hand, which is the most difficult thing because I was a pleaser. I was insecure. Somebody would say something about me and I would take it to heart. I'd put faith into it.
Right.
And it was terrible. The other side is to choose when you say, show me your friends, I'll show you your future. I use a pragmatic thing. I said, look, what you want in life, if you want a lot of money, then go find friends or mentors that are in the position or situation you want to be in. The people you get to choose to be around,
yep,
those are the ones that we have to really be, I think, pragmatic and calculate. Look, this is what I want, because those are the people that are going to elevate our understanding, our awareness, and our frequency, and also provide us opportunity. My life has changed always by people that, you know, can stroke $1 million check, just like my broke friends can stroke a $10 check. There's two different energies of the world of manifestation. One is money. It's an object of energy that we put into the flow, and usually we use Amazon now to get what we want. And the other is faith. And so if you're not a realist, if you don't realize that I should have economically and surround myself with the right friends that have a lot of resources for me, I'm not doing myself any justice. I'm diminishing my capacity to manifest on this pragmatic earth of getting money. And that was one thing that I think I did very, very well, is I had those mentors. I surrounded myself with people. Like when I was in law school, I got two job offers for one reason. Right, I did very well. I worked hard and smart and long, but I became friends. I went to Greece and became friends with the head guy named Professor Ioannopoulos, who wrote the Louisiana treaties, who was so connected, and the dean of the law school, because I knew one thing. I went to the law school because the dean told me, if you come here, I'll take care of you. And I said, you know what? That's going to get me a job, because that guy's going to know who has the jobs, and I want to be an oil and gas litigator. And so I made friends and went to Greece. And literally, that's my focus. It wasn't to get all A's from the guy. It was literally so he liked me. And all I did was ask him for help. I told him, you know what? I want to be just like you when I grow up. Can you help me? And I flattered him, just like people flatter us. And the guy made me his mentee. And then when this job for legal research online came up from the publisher of his book, which he made seven figures from, they said, do you know any young guys who can sell ice to Eskimos that are good litigators? And I was top of his choice. And those two job offers changed my life. I was a millionaire 9 months out of law school because I took a job that paid $250,000 a year. And I figured out the math, how to literally work 56 days a week. And I did it by math, but people will laugh and say, you made $1 million in 9 months. I go, yeah, but I worked 10 years and I actually wasn't that good at it. I made $100,000 a year by working 10 years and 9 months, because I looked at productivity and I wanted, you know, most people are 8 hours productive in a day. I became 64 hours of productive 7 days a week. And I figured I'd beat him by math. I didn't have to be as good as a salesperson.
Now, didn't that like burn you out?
No. Well, that was the plug-in part that I started realizing at a young age. And I, you know, there's other guys, like, I don't know if you met Gary Vaynerchuk, because we
both feel it. Yeah.
So Gary feels the same way. I believe that it's the exact opposite. I believe that we become tired because we create interference between the power source. And, you know, here I was connected to the power source. I learned to love everything that I do. So if I'm pursuing something and that excitement keeps going, and I've used that source for so long to be more productive and accessible. And when I say accessible, I don't just mean accessibility to others. I mean accessing what I want. And no, I am one of those people, Dave, probably like you. I pass out, but I don't get exhausted and emotionally worn out. Because I go back to center when those negative energies start interfering with my direct connection to the source. And I constantly try to expand my connection to the source so I have more and more energy. And I believe that's really happening in my life.
Yeah, that's a really important nuance you just pointed out there. In fact, let me ask you this question. People ask me this a lot. What do you struggle with the most?
Ego. So okay. I struggle here. Here's the fact, and I'll give this great story, but this is the quintessential thing in my life. I wake up at 4 a.m. I meditate for 20. I then get ready and I go to the gym by 4:30 and I get home by 5:30 from the gym when I'm at home. I walk outside a Saturday morning at 4:30 and my 17-year-old daughter's car is not there. Now I know and I've learned everything that I'm supposed to do, but yet I pick up this phone. Mm-hmm. And I am one number away from yelling, swearing, screaming, yep. and destroying my relationship with my 17-year-old daughter.
Right.
I then stop, drop, and roll. I learn, I catch myself, and I put myself down, and then I call her calmly because I ask myself, why am I so mad? And I tell myself, because I'm scared to death. That's my baby. I can't, so you're going to ruin this relationship because you care about and love her, then treat her like you care about and love her. Don't treat it like her, you hate her. So I call her calmly and say, where are you? She says, I'm in bed. I'm like, where? In her house. Where's your car? It's at the grocery store. Kids were drinking. You told me, Dad, if kids are drinking, that I'm better off to Uber home. And I'm just listening to you. And I'm like, I am so sorry I woke you. Go back to bed. I'm proud of you. Now, that's years and years of thinking. The biggest problem or challenge I have is that we are here to learn lessons. If I learn the lessons, they'll stop coming. But here's the trick. No matter what lessons I've learned, and this is the biggest challenge I believe for everyone, I'm going to forget every lesson I learn from time to time. Whether it's gratitude, forgiveness, I'm going to forget those lessons. So how well practiced, how strong is the muscles that I have to try to remember, and I have the capability of remembering all lessons at any time. And because of the internet, I can access the lessons at any time. But no matter what, I can't give myself an egoectomy. I am always going to be struggling and fighting the ego-based consciousness that will create shortages, voids, obstacles, and resistance in my life. It is the challenge of all challenge, how quickly I can get to peace and how often I can stay at peace. And this, to me, is my ultimate life goal, because I think the better we become at it, the more happy we are. And the cool thing about happiness is it affects everybody biochemically, the people that receive it, the people that witness it. And we can change the world if we figure out systematically, mathematically, scientifically, happiness, and get better, work those muscles to stay at peace and not live in ego-based consciousness of fear.
That's a pretty powerful answer. Now, what's the difference between struggling with something and then working on something? Like, is constant vigilance a struggle, or is struggle itself an ego thing?
Yeah, so I believe that within every struggle is ego, right? Because you would have to want something that's missing. I believe that if you're pursuing something, there's always ego involved. And where I like to go with that to understand the distinction is fear. And you gave a speech at the TLC with your lion creature, I forget his name, that represented the ego. And I learned so much from that, because I learned about the actual basics of the ego and of fear and all of that. And what was interesting is I looked at it on a sports level and said, so many athletes tell me that they're motivated by fear. And then listening to your speech, I was like, this is impossible. Dave's teaching me all this stuff about the ego. The ego is one of the biggest depreciators of energy. It actually, is a soul sucking thing, but yet you taught me fear has a purpose. It provides extreme focus. And what we do is we get mistaken by an energy sucker that we're focused. I'll give you an example. You know, the old lady that picks up the car because the baby's run over. Well, people think that she was inspired by fear. No, she wasn't. She got hyper-focused. It created a biochemical reaction that created great strength from great focus to to help the baby. But nobody talks about what happened to that lady afterwards. She had torn ligaments, muscles, strained back. It took her weeks, if not months, to recover. And that's what we do with fear. It's not a sustainable thing in order to expand and accelerate what we want. So what do? I think the struggle and challenge is, how do I substitute something with fear? How can I, when fear's there, put it into the right trajectory and move it into an inspiration, move it into a pursuit that has positive qualities so that I can expand. But at its core, when you have a challenge or a struggle to get something, when you're pursuing something, you still have a perspective of just enough or not enough. Because if you truly, how do we balance living in a world of more than enough and still living by the law of Goya? Why would you work hard, smart, and long if you already have everything that you've ever wanted or ever needed? That's the ultimate, to me, mental struggle in my life is like, I get more than enough, but I'm not willing to participate in that game yet, in the ultimate infinity game. I'd rather, I enjoy the pursuit. I enjoy the consistent, persistent challenges. I enjoy the idea that at times I live in a world of more than enough, but yeah, there's just enough sometimes for me. I want more.
Got it. And so that's sort of how you think about struggle. You talk a lot in your new book about offense and defense, you know, of branding and marketing, of communication, and also just the core, you know, the happy athlete and the guys I've met who are top of their game. I'm thinking of like the Bryan brothers and Nick Foles and a few of them. They're like profoundly spiritual, at least some of the time, and certainly like humble. And, you know, there's a different energy to them than the, you know, I'm going to kill the enemy kind of thing, which is, you know, the stereotypical sports movie. So like it's very different than I would expect it to be, but how do you take that, you know, offense and defense, which is frankly, those are egoic things like, okay, I've got to, you know, take, or I've got to protect. All right. How do you apply that to something like branding or marketing? Like how does that work?
Yeah. So, you know, just in all transparency, which I try to be and illuminate things, right? When we put titles onto, things, we have publishers that may not understand what we understand. So yes, the offense and defense for me though is understanding frequency. So branding and marketing, you know, I've been blessed to run the most notable sports agency in the world. So we have brands like Troy Aikman, Steve Young, Warren Moon, Lennox Lewis, Evander Holyfield, probably even names that you recognize. You don't have to be a sports hero to know.
Yeah, no, those are names I know. I do live in a cave, but it's not that deep.
Right. And so, you know, that was what makes the Jerry Maguire thing nice, but it's really about three parts of frequency. And I think it's more important than ever because of social media, that before we could only reach so many people. Now, 4.2 billion and growing are available to us to hear our frequency. So what are the three things we look at in the offense and defense of marketing and branding? One, the strength of your signal, right? How far is that signal going to reach by how high the frequency or vibration is? More important than even the strength of the signal, I believe the spectrum of your signal. You know, there's people that speak and multitudes of demographics it resonates with. And you and I both have experienced this. One of the most remarkable things that's happened to me is I did a keynote speech for the Denny's franchise, 7,000 franchisees, big, huge stage. And I talked about saying thank you before you go to bed and when you wake up is the easiest way to change your life. And I gave them a gratitude challenge and said, anyone that can do that, I guarantee that your life will change within 30 days.
It's true.
People lined up for an hour to an hour and 15 minutes to speak with me, to tell me that I had now changed their life, that they were going to say thank you every day. And that they had to tell me that this was a significant thing. Now, every one of those people had heard gratitude before, but it was now the force of my signal in the spectrum in which the frequency that it touched them emotionally, right? Here's the offense and defense of it. And then the last part is because of practice, I have greater clarity in what I'm saying. And a lot of what we speak about, why it resonates is because we've taken highly complex, confusing, metaphysical, physical, you know, things that most people won't understand if we were talking at a scientific level from your neurofeedback training to everything. And you break it down to, hey, dude, say thank you when you go to bed and when you wake up and you'll change your life for 30 days. There's a magic in that clarity.
Okay. So it's about having some spark of communication or the ability to say it in a way that it lands. And yeah, that is the greatest challenge in what I do. And it's
That's why I became a teacher years ago at the University of California. I think I'd like to learn how to do that, but someday I'll be an expert. Because it's the hardest thing. So translating knowledge into actionable materials is tough. But you clearly, Forbes named you as one of the most sought after inspirational speakers. So I'd say you kind of nailed that one.
We're getting there, yeah.
But it's a constant challenge, and I'm thinking about what you said there. Okay, publishers have you do this and have you do that, and I do the same thing in my books. It's like, all right. How do I put the words on the cover that are frankly going to appeal to someone's ego so that they'll read the book, even if part of what's in the book is, hey, here's how you manage that ego that made you pick up the book, whether it's a diet book or a personal development book or whatever. And it sounds like you kind of did the same thing. But
yeah, my next book's worse because it's going to be Don't Do Business with Dicks.
If only I had that advice when I was young.
It's going to be a bestseller. It could be empty on the inside. That title will sell millions of books.
It is a great title. And are you really going to write that one?
Oh, I wrote it already. Okay, literally. Good. Yeah.
Yeah, it's true. The problem is, and I'm going to be real crass here, having a good dick detector is hard because the best dicks hide themselves.
Right,
and they're hard to find. All right, so since you now we're going to go into your next book that people can't even buy yet. So, all right, how do you spot the dicks early?
Well, being a recovering manipulator, liar, overseller, and back end seller, what I've learned is, like any decision, and I'm going to go back to the book I just wrote. What it is why do very successful people make decisions so quickly. It's a habit that I have seen, the trend that I've seen. Very successful people make quick decisions. It's because they know their values. Not only do they know their values, at a higher statistical success, they live by their values. Just like we were talking about frequency, that's what people mean by authentic. It's overused and misused when we say got to be authentic, right? No, you got to find your frequency. You got to know what you are. You got to know what your values are. So what I did through experience is I broke down my values to four things. And I knew that every day I had to evaluate the percentage of those values because they're going to change throughout my lifetime. So I have personal values. So some of the significant things I do personally is a minimum of 1 hour a day is for my health. That is a new thing that I do the last 2 years, and it has changed. Go back and look at videos. This is a different embodiment because every day before my family, before my work, my job, that my health. Well, personal values, then I have experiential values. And at a younger age, my experiential values, in fact, I'm sending my middle child to college. And I told her, this is an experiential thing. I really just wanted you to learn, you could sit at home with me and I'll tell you the websites to go to and the videos to watch. And you'd be a lot cheaper than, trust me, a lot cheaper than I'm paying. But it's an experience. Then every day, what are my giving values? What am I going to produce today? And then what are my receiving values? What do I want to ask for? What am I going to receive? And I think that in order to have a dick detector, that when we're firm and understand what the values that we have for that day are, objective of our values, when someone is not aligned with those values, we have to walk away. It's not going to get any better. So when someone makes a racist remark to me, and I used to play it off and say, well, not a big deal, that's a significant thing to me. I don't want to be around that energy. I don't care if it's ignorance. I don't have to change the person, but I don't have to be around it and I don't have to do business with it. I don't want to be around low energy. And I've learned that if you're not aligned with my values, then I'm going to find someone that is. And, you don't have to be exactly on my values, but there's certain things in my value system that I won't do business with. I won't choose to be with you.
Yeah. I like that. So just having the values. And by the way, you and I share that health one, and most people don't. I work with the Bulletproof employees and the same thing. Like, look, you can't take care of your family. You can't take care of your job if you can't take care of yourself. So, yeah. People say, I need to take time off. And I'm like, good.
Me too.
Because if you don't take care of your health, you can't do anything. And like, why do I want sick people at the office? Yeah. Like, that doesn't make any sense.
Well, I tell people all the time, if you don't take time for your wellness, then you better store up time for your illness.
Yeah, it's true. But you know how few people listening to this right now actually put their health above their family?
I didn't for 49 years. And I knew health was important, but I did not. And it's so hard to walk away from your 9-year-old and say, hey, buddy, I can't do this with you right now because I promised myself I'm going to go do 30 minutes of cardio on the Peloton.
Yep.
You know, for me and for you, because I'm going to be a great dad to you because I'm going to live a lot longer and I'm going to be able to run with you, you know, when I'm 60.
Yeah. And, you know, it's really hard. It's, you know, my son's 9 as well. And you're like, man, I'd really rather do something more fun. So, but that said, I know that if I don't do that, and it comes to food and it comes to exercise and sleep and all that stuff. And the self-sacrificing stuff, even that your mom did, right? It probably wasn't in her best interest, and maybe she could have, you know, been a better mom if she sacrificed less.
Yeah, she's a catalyst. I tell her all the time, I said, isn't it ironic that all your children have to take care of you because you didn't take care of yourself? You put everybody before you. And I said, I don't mind. Yeah, that. I go, I don't mind. But I go, it's kind of like, what if you used all of that catalytic power to build yourself up so you could just empowered us. You know what I mean? Like literally we're in a different economy. And she would always say when she said I was lost about money, my justification was always, you know what? I want to make enough money to hire 1,000 of you because I don't need to personally go teach second grade. I'd rather hire 1,000 unbelievable teachers like you that can teach the second grade and donate that money. And so it was always this complete different philosophy. She was the catalyst and, you know, I was the source.
That's cool. Well, I really appreciate that you shared just that you've made that change as a hyper successful guy, right? I mean, in multiple careers and all that, you know, big charity. Like, I don't know, you kind of fit the mold for a guy who's kicking ass on multiple levels. But even with all that, only 2 years ago did you say, oh, hey, I'm going to put my health ahead of all that stuff so I can do all that stuff. I want everyone listening to the show to really just let that sink in for a minute because I don't think enough of us do that. And in fact, because of our puritanical Western upbringing, we actually value, I'm on the grind. I'm going to hustle. Like I'm going to eat garbage for 3 years and it's going to make me rich. And it's like, actually eating garbage for 3 years, even if you make some money, it's going to make you poor.
Yeah.
And I feel like that message doesn't get out there enough. So thanks for saying it.
Can I tell you what's interesting? To reiterate that, I was on this unbelievable panel, CEO, chairman of Burger King, you know, HBO's head, and all these extraordinary people. And they asked, what's the number one piece of advice that you would give? And here I was again, you know, be kind to your future self, do good deeds, right. You know, and other people are like, study harder. But I love the lady from HBO. Because you weren't expecting it, she said, and I wish I would have said it because I agreed with her and said, I'm taking back mine. I believe hers is the best advice. She said, find something that you love to do for your health that you can do your entire life and do it every day.
Wow.
And so I'm sitting there living, you know, my minimum of an hour a day, but it was so ingrained in her to know that that is actually the most important thing that she could teach all of these, you know, thousands of kids was simply find something that you love to do for your health every single day that you can do the rest of your life. And I said, that is it. Just like you're saying, you cannot ignore it because if you put your family in business before your health, you'll never choose your health.
I mean, you and I have both given lots of keynotes to rooms full of, I'm going to be real stereotypical here because this is what it actually looks like, fat old white guys. You know what I'm talking about?
Yeah.
Those are...
You see it,
right? And the world is changing. Now, we actually have rooms where we have fat, old, mixed race and mixed genders. You know?
Yeah, exactly.
But still, the fat and old and unhealthy.
Unfortunately, I think we have more young fat people.
That's true.
You know, with a trend, I see, you know, more fit 30, 40, and 50-year-olds than I do 20-year-olds.
That's true. And you're not exactly 10% body fat right now. So this isn't about fat shaming at all. I'm using fat as a proxy for unhealthy people who are highly successful. And I want to change the picture of that to say, hey, part of being successful is you took care of yourself because who really cares if you lead a big company, if you're tired in pain and you act like a jerk half the time because of it. And I didn't get that early on in my career. So let's hope that the world is changing from that front. And every time you give a talk like that, I think you're doing your part to help, help the current generation see what you've seen and the next generation too.
And it's interesting too, because not just fat, like you said, my father gave me a great warning sign at 30. I wasn't close to him, but I had hated him because he forgot my birthday when I was 10. He sends me a birthday gift. My dad smoked 3 packs of cigarettes a day. He's now dead at 80 from a genetic family that lives to 97, 100. And literally he ate wrong. It wasn't that he was fat, right? He just wasn't healthy, like you said. So it's more than just being fat. He gave me a jacket when I was 30 years old and tore out all the pockets. And I called him upset. I was like, what are you doing? Are you torturing me? He said, I don't want you to be like me. And I'm like, what do you mean? He goes, I've sacrificed everything for money. And he says, I'm hanging that jacket in your closet to remind you of me every day, to remind you, you can't take anything with you when you're gone. You don't need to be the richest man in the cemetery, right? And when I was 30, he was already 60. And wow. You know, he only had 20 more years, but I think he already felt the mistakes. And one of them being that he was unhealthy. He coughed up a lung every time, you know, he spoke with me, even when he was 60 years old. I would say in my life, my family lived so long that my dad, for what he did to himself, was a genetic freak, because living on candy and cigarettes to 80 is a miracle.
Yeah, that's pretty tough to do. I don't think I have those genetics. Let's put it that way, man. Crazy pants stuff, but a lot of people I think are weaker now than they used to be.
Yeah.
Well, I mean, this is fascinating to get inside, you know, why you are who you are, because, you know, I don't know if I did a good enough job of kind of explaining at the beginning of the show, the level of success you've lived in order to be able to sit down and say, I've just written this book that's worth reading, right? Because it's easy to write a book. I mean, there's a lot of 22-year-old life coaches out there. And you know, they can write a book, but you're like, who are you copying? Cause I want to talk to that guy. Cause you haven't lived it enough. Like you haven't done the work yet. But you've done the work, and you know, you've been really high and really low and gone back to really high. One more question for you, which is cool. Cause we're ending on health anyway. Now, question for you, you're a little bit older than I am, but how long do you think you've got? Given what you know about your health.
I love that question. Yeah. I know, and I used to tell people that I was going to die at 111 on January 11th at 111. I was born January 11th at 111, but Diane Cannon, who's 84 years old and wears 5-inch heels, and we share our Laker seats down there on the baseline of Laker games. I told her that. I said, I know that I'm going to live to 111. And she looked me in the eyes and said, why are you limiting yourself? She was literally
like
sad.
Already.
She was. So now I say, at a minimum, Dave, I'm going to live to a minimum of 111. And I'll decide past that. But minimum, I know at least 111 years old.
You know, that is a profoundly good answer. And people in media, they're like, you're going to live to 180. I'm like, no. At least, like, don't limit me, man. Like, that's rude.
Exactly. Good. Right? Exactly. Don't limit me either. Always say minimum or at least.
Yeah.
Universe doesn't know numbers. You just create resistance. That's all.
Exactly. So that's a minimum. So there you go. At least 111. And is that based on any sort of like, because now I'm exercising, now I'm eating the right diet? Or is that just because I'm bullheaded and I've got willpower to manifest it?
I guess there's three things there. One, genetically, right? My great aunts, the grandparents lived to 97, great aunts to 106. So yeah. I think genetically I have a good disposition to make it. I think I have the attitude to make it. And now I think I have the practice to even make it and feel good at 111, right? I'm not just talking live into 111.
Oh, yeah.
I'm not going to be in a bed. I'm going to fall asleep one night, and when I'm over 111 somewhere in there, I'm just going to, instead of just passing out going to bed, I'm going to pass out and go to my next journey.
Yep, there you go. I like that too. Yeah, the definition of living isn't tubes and monitors. Although, frankly, if those are necessary, you might want to do that for a week or two. But beyond that, no.
Heal. They're for healing. Tubes and monitors are for healing, not for living.
There you go. Well put. Well, David, it's been a great pleasure. People can find your new book online by looking for Game Time Decision Making. And your website, davemeltzer.com, MELTZER. Anywhere else they should go?
at David Meltzer, David Meltzer on YouTube, David Meltzer on LinkedIn. So, you know, and you can use dmeltzer.com too. So I'm trying to get away from, there's that marketing side, that Dave and David confusion. So David Meltzer for the book. Yeah.
Oh, so the other book Dave is Meltzer. David, but your website's Dave. Oh my God.
Yeah. That's why I switched it to D Meltzer. Cause the guy who owns David Meltzer wouldn't give it to me.
Oh man, that guy. Well, go do some energetic forgiveness gratitude.
Exactly. It's right there, the power.
And so you guys can't see him on the screen, but he just did a mudra from like a yoga practice for forgiveness.
The Judah Buddha's at work.
All right. It's been a great pleasure to chat with you again. And I think last time we chatted was actually at the Unstoppable Gala to raise all that money for girls in Africa, which is awesome.
Thank you, by the way.
Thank you for that work as well. If you're listening to this and you're excited about that idea that what would happen if there were schools for girls in villages where there never have been schools for girls before? Well, it turns out that's a big charity thing that you can do, and it's called the Unstoppable Foundation. And I'm a supporter. I donate 40 years of Zen Things for auction at that, and David runs it. So that's another place to go if that just piques your charitable interest. It's a long-term investment, but it's worth doing as well.
Thank you.
If you liked today's episode, you know what to do. Go out there and read Game Time Decision Making, or maybe just sleep better or have a gratitude practice or any of the other things that actually don't require you to put butter in your coffee. But frankly, you might want to do that too. You just don't have to.
A Human Upgrade, formerly Bulletproof Radio, was created and is hosted by Dave Asprey. The information contained in this podcast is provided for informational purposes only and is not intended for the purposes of diagnosing, treating, curing, or preventing any disease. Before using any products referenced on the podcast, consult with your healthcare provider, carefully read all labels, and heed all directions and cautions that accompany the products. Information found or received through the podcast should not be used in place of a consultation or advice from a healthcare provider. If you suspect you have a medical problem or should you have any healthcare questions, please promptly call or see your healthcare provider. This podcast, including Dave Asprey and the producers, disclaim responsibility for any possible adverse effects from the use of information contained herein. Opinions of guests are their own, and this podcast does not endorse or accept responsibility for statements made by guests. This podcast does not make any representations or warranties about guest qualifications or credibility. This podcast may contain paid endorsements and advertisements for products or services. Individuals on this podcast may have a direct or indirect financial interest in products or services referred to herein. This podcast is owned by Bulletproof Media.